Welcome to Observation. It's the program that considers the things of God and compares them to the ideas of man. In this regard, it's my pleasure to welcome one of the most informed individuals I've had the pleasure of getting to know. His name is Roy Goodman. He lives in the land down under. Roy is a scientist, and for those who may not be familiar with Roy's name as part of the series of programs, Roy and I did a program on dimensions, which was one of the most listened to, one of my favorite in the history of both Shattering Myths and Yada Ya Radio, something that maybe we will have to delve into once again. But it's good to hear your voice, Roy. Welcome to Observations.
Thank you, Craig, and thank you, Scott. And I'd like to start off with a bit of history, if I may.
Please.
In 1860, in Oxford's Natural History Museum, a famous debate between Thomas Huxley, otherwise known as Darwin's Bulldog, and Bishop Samuel Wilberforce occurred. This debate is considered a pivotal historic moment when science supposedly defeated religion on the question of the origin of all life and the laws governing human behaviour. Now, with this, after this debate, mankind could formulate his own laws and live in freedom from a harsh and unforgiving God, or so they thought.
Yeah, let's pause there just a moment, right? That's where a place where I wanted to begin, because this debate was between a fellow who chose to extrapolate far beyond what Darwin had observed and written. And his name was Thomas Huxley. He is the founder of the religion of man, socialist secular humanism. Humanism as a religion is actually formulated by this individual. So what we have is the religion of man pitted against not God, but against religion. It was really a competition on that debate between two religions, was it not?
That's correct. I have to say that Huxley was not really the progenitor of it. I mean, that sort of idea had been going on for hundreds or if not thousands of years beforehand. I mean, God has never been really popular.
Well, it's true. There's always been ideas that elevating man to the status of God. As a matter of fact, virtually every pagan religion depicts gods in the image of man. That's why all the statues of false gods throughout history are always done in a man-like or woman-like form. And we've always projected our characteristics on our gods. It's just that Huxley is the Humanist Manifesto is a product of Huxley. He codified what others had been brewing and developing for some time. But the thing that most people don't recognize that's essential about this particular chasm in human history, this fulcrum of human history, is that what Huxley had to say on behalf of his extrapolations of Darwin, much of what he had to say has subsequently either proven to be untrue or misinformed, and the foe he was debating against was essentially Roman Catholicism as opposed to Yahweh's testimony in Bar Sheath Genesis.
Correct. Yes, that's right. But of course, they didn't know very much about what was in the cells or in our cells at that time. In fact, they thought it was just simply a piece of gelatin-like material with a membrane around the outside. And had they known what we now know, I don't think Huxley would have got off the ground in the debate. He would have just been destroyed.
If we knew,
because Wilberforce didn't know that, and even though Wilberforce had known that, it still remains a debate between two corrupt religions.
Yeah, if it had been a scientific debate on the spontaneous generation of life without any outside influence and its onward and upward migration ever since that moment, based between two informed scientists, Huxley would have been rendered such a fool, no one would have ever heard of this debate.
That's right, yes, exactly.
Yeah. It's almost always the case that science argues on behalf of what it thinks to be true or believes to be true at the moment, only to find out that almost none of it is true. For example, when that debate took place, 90% of scientists, maybe more, believed in a thing called the steady-state universe, that the universe was the constant I am, that it had always existed, and that it had never been created. The notion that the universe was created was anathema to them. Is that true?
Yes, that's completely true. In fact, a British cosmologist by the name of Fred Hoyle proposed a concept called panspermia, which was based entirely upon the steady-state universe. Mm-hmm. The steady-state universe had the problem that they couldn't quantify the generation of new energy that was required to keep the universe steady-state.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the universe, as they could see it, was winding down. The suns, for example, were burning up their fuel and dissipating the energy.
All right.
So where did new energy come from? That was a problem they had. So they had to figure out a way, or tried to figure out a way of creating new energy, which is scientifically really quite dubious. It just just didn't hang together. So
so then there was a discovery called the redshift proved, and this was in the 20th century, that the redshift was discovered. In other words, approximately 100 years after this debate, that proved that the creation, that the universe was created, and that God's, his name is Yahweh's, proposition that the universe was created and had a beginning was in fact true, and that science was entirely wrong.
Well, science was wrong insofar as the hypotheses were at that time, yes.
Yeah, the steady-state universe was an entirely errant proposition.
Yeah, the steady state, but not all science, of course, was wrong. It's just that the hypotheses that have been made concerning the universe were then wrong. That's true.
Yeah, the topic we're discussing is the topic that they discussed in large degree, which did the universe always exist, or was it created? And science held that the universe had always existed. They were shown to be wrong by Hubble.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
And that the redshift was the phenomenon that proved beyond any doubt that the universe was expanding, and the fact that it's expanding, you extrapolate backwards, it had to have a beginning.
Yes, that's right. It was expanding because of the redshift.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that due to the Doppler shift, I don't know whether people are familiar with this. Doppler shift simply means that there's a change in the frequency, whether if something's moving away from you or towards you.
Yeah.
Now, something's moving away from you and it's emitting a signal that's coming towards you, the wavelength of that signal gets stretched. It gets longer and longer. Now, the lower end of the energy range or the frequency range is red. The higher energy of the frequency range is blue.
Mm-hmm.
So that means if something's moving towards you, or even parallel to you, such as the Andromeda Nebula, which is moving more or less parallel to us, it's the only one that has a slight blue shift towards us. Mm-hmm. All the other galaxies have a red shift, and in fact, the red shift gets very much bigger the further away they are. So they're not only just simply moving away at the constant speed; they're actually accelerating away from us.
Yes,
and That redshift was then used to, or conceptually, if the redshift is occurring and you look in every direction, you see everything moving away from you. And if you run the camera backwards, then everything will come towards you and eventually end up in a point which we call a singularity, or what's now known as the Big Bang. That is, this came out of nowhere, or seemed to come out of nowhere.
So when Hubble came up with this this realization, and then they ran the tape backwards, if you will, in their minds, and they were correct to do so, redshift and the Doppler shift is a reality, it's not a theory.
That's correct.
Then, and they came up with this idea that, okay, so the universe we now know was created But they didn't still want to acknowledge that Yahweh, the author of the Torah, was correct. So they entitled the creative event the Big Bang. But didn't God use exactly that same phrase to describe the creation of the universe?
He did, in Bar Rashid.
Yes. 3,500 years before man would apply the same term. As a matter of fact, if we roll back the, I know we want to talk mostly about evolution here, but just thinking a moment about the creative event, all we're able to measure from this this Big Bang is the quark confinement, the point where energy can coalesce into matter. Prior to that time, time does not flow or move in a way that we can calibrate it as we do now.
That's right, but it moves very slowly. The higher you go in mass, mm-hmm. the more slowly the relatively, that is mm-hmm. to us. In other words, if you're looking at someone from a distance who is very massive, the time that person clock, or the person's clocks will have, is slower than the clocks that we have.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that to us, they appear to be sort of moving along at a snail's pace. So the further, the more massive you become, and that implies going up in dimensions as well,
mm-hmm.
then the slower and slower time becomes. But this is only a hypothesis on my part, I can't prove it, but I suspect that time never actually stands still completely. But there's always some degree of movement. Say, for example, in Yah's dimension, whatever that may be, we postulate at the moment that it's the seventh dimension. His time, in fact, to him, may be quite normal. He's doing his things and everything's moving along quite nicely. But if we were somehow able to see him, then he would appear to be us to be completely stationary. Whereas, on the other hand, when he was looking at us, it'd be zipping past at enormous speed. This is why you can have, for example, 6 days of creation from his point of view. So he looks forward in time and sees our existence going past at an enormous speed, whereas we can look back over a period of 50 or, say, 14 billion years approximately,
mm-hmm.
To see the same events occurring in our time frame.
As a matter of fact, we can actually measure the difference in the speed that time moves relative to the creative event based upon the stretching of the wavelengths and the cosmic microwave radiation that's left over from that Big Bang event.
That's correct, yes.
And
that was done by a fellow called, what was his name now? Schroeder.
Yes, Schroeder was the first to apply the math to it, but the analysis of the stretching of the wavelength based upon what occurred during the Big Bang, the Wilkinson probe and many others have consistently been able to calibrate the stretching of the slowing of time at the creative event. It's approximately 10 to the 12th power, is it not?
Roughly that, and the way that they got that was that the when the Big Bang occurred, it was extremely hot, unimaginably hot. As it cooled, you found these things called quarks appeared, which weren't things that we're familiar with in our terrestrial existence. But they, as the temperature further cooled, they got to a point where they coalesced together, according to the laws of physics which then apply, to form the basic building blocks of our matter, such as neutrons and electrons and protons.
Mm-hmm.
This was called quark confinement. Mm-hmm. It wasn't actually an event well defined in time. That is to say, there was sort of a bit of a variation in time as to when it actually occurred. And this is one of the reasons why the Hubble estimate, for example, of 13.7 billion years may be out by a little bit.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it appears that it's off for a number of reasons. We did a whole program on the three different means of evaluating that particular time.
That's right.
but there are now discoveries of distant stars and galaxies that suggest that the universe is older than their 13.7 billion estimate. The most likely number when you evaluate the various options that are available to us on quark confinement is just shy of 15 billion years, isn't it? Just a little over a billion years longer than is the most popularly promoted theory at this point.
That's right. No one can be really certain of the exact figure there. That's the thing.
Yeah.
One thing we can be certain of is that there's the background temperature of space. And that's what gives you the 10 to the 12 power, approximately 10 to the 12. It's not exactly that, but it's close enough. So the difference between the temperature at quark confinement and the temperature of free space now, which is 2.73 degrees absolute. People who don't know what absolute means is that if you keep going backwards in temperature, it gets colder and colder, obviously. But you get to a point where it's called absolute zero. And that, in our centigrade scale, is minus 273 point, a few little decimal places as well. The interesting thing is that you can't get to that temperature. As you get closer and closer to it, it becomes what's called asymptotic. That is to say that the efforts to get there sort of move you along a line that's approaching the absolute zero, but it's like a black hole. You can never quite get to the singularity, which in this case is absolute zero. But it's approximately 273 degrees below zero in the centigrade scale, which makes it pretty damn cold. So at 2.73 degrees, that's where the residual microwaves have stretched to. Now, a microwave is just another form of electromagnetic radiation.
Mm-hmm.
It's been all stretched out. It comes from the same thing I was talking to you before about the Doppler shift, but it's not the same scientifically as the Doppler shift. It's due to the space itself stretching. And as it stretches, the wavelength stretches as well. So it starts off as gamma rays, which are extremely high energy electromagnetic radiation, right at the other end of the scale. And as space stretched, it stretched out to be 2.73 degrees absolute, or very, very long wavelength microwave radiation. So the difference between those two temperatures, or the difference between the wavelengths, if you like, gives you that figure of approximately 10 to the 12. That's where that all came from.
And if you divide the most likely estimate of the universe's longevity from the point of the Big Bang, multiply that billions of years times days in a year, and divide that by 10 to the 12th.
You come to a number that's an approximate number, because we have only an approximate estimate of both quark confinement and the age of the universe. So but that approximate number is pretty damn close to six. And in fact, when I first saw that, that made me sit up, because I was before that at least an agnostic.
Yeah.
And as soon as I saw that, I said, hello, what's going on here? How could Moshe have known that number? Of all the possible numbers you could choose, he just happened to choose the right one? Is he very good at gold lotto or what?
Yeah, that was the realization that where I transitioned from a faith-based creature that was curious as to whether or not God existed and he could be known, to an individual who knew, was absolutely confident that the author of the Torah had proven his existence. And there's really no possibility that you would come to that number by chance. Now let's transition, if we could, from the age of the universe, because the age of the universe actually has a lot to do with the discussion on evolution. I remember a series of Scientific American articles that the basic theme was, it's improbable that life could have emerged from random chance. But given enough time, the improbable moves all the way to probable. And the numbers on improbable are mind-boggling, and we'll consider those in a moment. And what they were talking about is that that they thought that they could play this game over the 4.8 billion years that the Earth had existed. But they really didn't have that much time, did they?
No, they certainly didn't. I'll have to disagree with the age of the Earth. I think it's 4.5 billion, but I mean, that's just a quibble.
Okay.
After the Earth had formed in the primordial disk, again, there's sort of a bit of a backtrack here, a gas and dust cloud collapsed to form the Sun and the planets.
Right.
And as that was called an accretion disk, that is to say that everything was being accreted, if you like, by gravity into the center. Something had disturbed that gas cloud to cause it to start to collapse. Once it started to collapse, then it had to continue, because it was just simply falling down a gravitational well, if you like. And the Sun formed, the planets then formed around it, and the mechanics of it is really quite mathematically interesting.
Let's speak a moment there, because what we're talking about here is a universe that is between 14 and 15 billion years old in all likelihood, but an Earth that is just 4.5 billion years old. One of the things that's really interesting about all of this is that our Sun and the Earth have to be the derivative of a collapsed star, don't they? Aren't we, at the very least, a second-generation star and solar system?
Well, yes. First of all, the Earth has to be the same age as the Sun, obviously. I mean, this came from the same accretion disk. So that means that all the dust and gas that was in that accretion, or in that cloud, the primordial cloud, had to contain heavy elements that have come from supernova explosions. Now, can I backtrack here a minute? The nuclear reactions that occur inside stars is quite interesting. It starts off with hydrogen, which burns, and when it burns, it turns into helium. And then you've got a shell of helium around that core of hydrogen, if you like, that's burning, and that turns into the next heavier elements and so on. And that process gives off energy up until you get to the point of iron. Now, after iron, you can't form the heavier elements by nuclear fusion. So what has to happen to produce that is a gigantic explosion called a supernova. Now, the very, very heavy stars, and our Sun won't end like this, but once you get above about 4 solar masses, when the stars, because the stars are burning their fuel much faster, the heavier they get, they burn them faster, they ultimately come to the point of the iron catastrophe. That is to say that they can't continue to burn the nuclear fuel to oppose the gravitational collapse of the star. So what then happens is that the nuclear reactions stop, the pressure caused by the burning against gravity stops, the star then collapses in upon itself and turns into an extremely dense core. If it's a certain mass, it will go into what's called a neutron star, and the neutron star will then, the infalling material hitting that mass has so much energy that when it hits it, it forms the heavier nuclei and then rebounds, if you like, off into space. So now you've got space scattered with all of these things like gold and silver and platinum and whatever. The really interesting thing is, I mentioned Fred Hoyle before. He came up with he was really quite bright. He came up with a notion as to how carbon was formed. And since we need carbon to make our forms of life, that is a vital nuclear reaction, but it's a very curious one, because it's based upon the 2 helium nuclei and 1 beryllium nucleus. Now, beryllium is the fourth. It goes hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium. That's the fourth atom on the periodic table. So it requires 2 helium nuclei and a beryllium nucleus to come together to form carbon. But it doesn't work unless the beryllium is in an excited state. And Hoyle worked out that the probability of this occurring is extremely small. So the fact that we've got so much carbon around is a very curious phenomenon. it's as if it's been, as he would say, monkeyed with to produce
yes.
what is required. And in fact, if I may quote,
but what he means by monkeyed with is that if you just run probabilities based upon the laws of physics, you just don't get there.
That's right. Yes.
There had to be an outside influence. But go ahead, read what he had to say.
He said, would you not say to yourself, some supercalculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom. Otherwise, the chance of my finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me to be so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. And another part that he quoted is...
That is profound. I mean, with the exception of the terminology, we don't very much like to view God in the monkeyed with terminology.
No.
And I'm sure he chose monkeyed with just to come off credible after he was saying, in essence, a superior intellect designed it and then acted upon it. If he had said superior intellect designed it and acted upon it, he would have been discredited. But if he used the term monkeyed with, then he's at least going to be considered in that community.
True, but he did in fact say, and if I can continue with another quote,
mm-hmm.
if one proceeds directly and straightforwardly in this matter, I don't know what he was referring to there, but
right.
Without being deflected by a fear of incurring the wrath of scientific opinion, one arrives at the conclusion that biomaterials with their amazing measure of order must be the outcome of intelligent design.
Yes,
and that
indeed.
Was Fred Hoyle, Evolution from Space. Now, of course, he was at least an agnostic, if not an atheist. So, of course, he was pushing the panspermia idea,
right.
Which we can come to later.
Yeah, so it's fairly amazing. By the way, I would ask you, what day, what numbers associated with man, and what day, according to Yahweh, in the progress of the evolving nature of the creation of the universe and in the authorship of life, what day was man conceived?
Six.
What is the atomic weight of carbon?
The atomic number?
The atomic number of carbon.
Yes, six.
Hmm. Yeah, and we are a carbon-based life form. Just an interesting coincidence, I'm sure. All right, so the reality is that even though the Earth may be 4.5 billion years old, you don't get the beginning of that time as to count in terms of your enormous chasms and eons of time for life to evolve, because the conditions didn't exist on Earth for a considerable period of time for life to be manifest. Isn't that correct?
That's right. If the Earth was 4.5 billion years old,
mm-hmm.
Again, as the accretion disk formed, all the matter that wasn't formed into planets was then sucked in by the gravitational pull of both the Sun and the planets.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this enormous cometary bombardment, not just of the Earth, but of all the planets, until, of course, all this material was swept away. So now we just have the more or less clear space around us that we have. So these infalling comets had energy, and that energy, when it hit the Earth, was dissipated in the form of heat. In fact, there was so much heat around that the Earth's original crust, that is before the bombardment, was melted.
Yes.
So it obviously couldn't support life. So until the cometary bombardment finished, then you had the problem of until the cometary bombardment finished, nothing could happen. So when it cooled, after the cometary bombardment had formed, and water could then exist as mm-hmm. water in pools and oceans and things mm-hmm. like that on the Earth, then and only then could life form. And in fact, it was demonstrated by a scientist called Professor Bargehorn that microfossils of a very ancient form of bacteria called a cyanobacterium were found in rocks in Nice, that's Geniss.
Mm-hmm.
That's a form of rock in Greenland.
Yes.
And what are called stromatolites. Now, stromatolites, in actual fact, still exist. And if you go to Shark Bay in my country, that is Western Australia, you can actually see what they look like. They're sort of like mushrooms sticking up, and they're full of bacterial colonies. Now, the significance of the bacterial colonies is that these particular things, a bit like green algae that you find in a pond, you go and have a look at algae in a pond and put it into sunlight, and you'll see bubbles starting to form. Mm-hmm. And those bubbles are oxygen.
Yes.
Now, the early Earth's atmosphere was thought to be reducing. That means to say that it didn't have any or little oxygen. It had all sorts of poisonous gases, from carbon dioxide to methane, to oxides of sulfur, oxides of nitrogen, even cyanides, for example, and it certainly wouldn't have lasted very long if you'd been on the Earth in those days.
So what you would have eroded, corroded.
Literally. In fact, our atmosphere probably would have looked a bit like Venus does today.
Roy, we're going to hold you on that point right there, and we'll be back with observations in just a moment.